Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and happy 2010. May this decade please be better than the last. I think most of us are putting positive energy in that direction anyway. Well, I'm your host, Karen Tate, of the long-running Voices of the Sacred Feminine radio show, and I thank you for tuning in to our currently running Four Mothers and Wayshowers series, which we're just past the midway point, I think, about now. Thank you, the listener, for making it so popular, and I have to give the wonderful artists who let me play their music during the show a big thank you and a plug. That particular group that you just heard that little snippet, that's a UK group called Be Optimistic, and the song was inspired by Goddess, and it's called Maria. Well, as for you, the listener, whether you've been with me the past 2 years or you're a newcomer, I don't mind saying every week I appreciate your listener loyalty, so please keep tuning in. Keep sending me those articles and emails. I love keeping that connection with you. And I'd love it if you'd mark my show as a favorite and become a friend of the show right there on Blog Talk. You can do all that from my show page that you tune into when you, when you pull it up and you decide which guest you're going to listen to. Well, speaking about your emails, I got a beautiful one over the holidays. It was surely a gift. And a particular friend of mine and I, we always talk about reminding ourselves to show gratitude for those gifts that the universe sends our way. So let me share it with you. And this was from a listener called Phoenix Rising. She says, "Hi, Karen. I just wanted to take a few minutes to thank you for all you do to open the eyes and hearts of people to Goddess. I know you work hard and you're getting her message out there, and I want you to know a little bit about me and how much I appreciate you. In September of 2009, on my 53rd birthday to be exact, I read a book, Women of Wisdom, that opened my eyes and started my journey to her. Since then, I've been reading through stacks of books, listening to CDs and radio shows, and watching DVDs. Your radio show was the first one I listened to. Over the past 3 months, I've listened to every show in your archives. I try to catch your live broadcast every week, and I encourage all my friends to do likewise. I also tweet it and post it to my Facebook page. And if I miss it, I always download it to listen later. I love your show. They're always informative. I've learned so much from you and your guests. I also read your Weekly Examiner article, tweet it, and post it to my Facebook page, too. As with your radio shows, the articles are always so enlightening. I just want you to know that you and your guests are changing lives, and I'm proof. You changed mine, so thank you. Peace, blessings, and much love to you." Well, Phoenix, love to you, too. Thank you so very much for sharing what the radio show means to you. It is a lot of fun to do every week, and it's my pleasure to talk to the guests that are so wonderful on the show. And it means a lot, though, that people are, like you are listening, and it's having an impact. So may she of 10,000 names embrace you in her golden wings. And as a reminder, before we get to tonight's guest, scholar Miriam Robbins-Dexter, I want to let you know we've moved the sometimes controversial but always informative What's the Buzz segment to the bottom of the show. That's the segment when I tell you about the bees that have been buzzing around in my bonnet all week, where we show how the sacred feminine or her ideals are relevant in today's world. And it's where I'm an equal opportunity whistleblower sometimes when women's rights are being trampled or oppressed, or anyone for that matter. The Goddess is about justice, harmony, balance, tolerance. So when these values aren't being adhered to, well, I'm going to tell you about it. But there's always good news, too. So stay tuned through the end of the show. we missed a whole lot the month of December with the holidays, and we're going to try to play catch up a bit. This week we're going to be covering some of the following items in What's the Buzz. I want you to know about the Shriver Report that's available on the internet to read online or download. It's an assessment of where women stand today, both good and bad. Also, you should be aware Iran is holding Iranian feminists and human rights activists in prison, and the Feminist Majority Foundation has a petition you might want to know about and sign. There's a Saudi journalist who's proposed an interesting idea I'm going to share with you. She says, give women the right to four husbands, like men have the right to multiple wives. So that's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but we'll have fun with that. Also, more serious, privatizing women, military prostitution in Iraq. There's also a 75-year-old woman in Saudi Arabia that's going to be flogged for associating with men. And finally, where's the outcry? I'm going to share an article with you, at least snippets from it, about why in our privileged and free society has been so unable to acknowledge the inhumanity and oppression of women. And if there's time, or maybe next week, we'll see how it goes, there's a couple noteworthy comments by Nicholas Kristof, a famous author of the book Half the Sky, who is an outspoken advocate of women's rights. So if you sent in any of those articles to me to share, you know who you are. Thank you. And let's see, so you'll want to be sure to stay tuned while those bees vent their relief later in the show. And just like you can call in and talk to our guest, you can call in later and talk to me about whatever's on your mind. The call-in number is 718-766-4662. And if you don't have pen and paper, it'll show up when you go to your computer and pull up Blog Talk Radio and Voices of the Sacred Feminine. So please consider calling in and speak to either Miriam or myself. But now, let me turn my attention to our guest who is patiently waiting, Miriam Robbins Dexter, and I want to read her bio to you. Miriam Robbins Dexter is the author of Whence the Goddess, a source book. She holds a BA in classics and a PhD in Indo-European studies, comparative linguistics, ancient Indo-European languages, archaeology, and comparative mythology, both from UCLA. She's the author of over 20 scholarly articles and 9 encyclopedia articles on ancient female figures. She's currently finishing a co-authored book manuscript, which she co-authored with Victor Meyer, and it's titled Sacred Display, Divine and Magical Female Figures of Eurasia, which will be published by Cambria Press, and we're going to talk more about that later on in the show. So Miriam, welcome to the show once again.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you. You were on my other show, Earth Sacred Places, talking about those sacred display figures, and I'm glad you're bringing a lot of this information to my new Blog Talk audience as well. Tonight, our topic is Kabili and the continuity of female iconography. Who are we talking about, first of all? Kabili and her Anatolian ancestors. I believe it's Kubaba and some of the prehistoric female figures.
Exactly.
All of
so.
Whom.
Exactly so, yes.
So tell us more about them. I'm sure we've seen a lot of these images. And am I saying Kabili right? I've heard it said so many different ways.
Well, the Greeks certainly would have said Kabili. It's been anglicized to Sibili, and I think that any pronunciation is fine.
Okay.
Whatever you're more comfortable using.
Okay, all right. Well, tell us more about her and her ancestors and roots.
Okay. Well, perhaps I should go chronologically back to the earlier figures. What I'm interested in about Sibili or Kabili is feline iconography associated with her that's been associated with Anatolian female figures going back hugely in time. And probably a lot of our audience knows of the large enthroned female figure. It was found in Çatalhöyük. It was found in a grain bin in a shrine, and it dates to about 6200 BCE. And she's on this throne, and the armrests are leopards. So she's one of the earliest female figures associated with felines. There are many also from Hajalar, which is slightly west of Çatalhöyük, dating to the late Neolithic. These are female figures associated with leopards in many different ways.
Now, does this have something to do with the goddess as mistress of animals? Is there any connection there at all?
I'm sure there is. Exactly so. And we find that in the early historic period, of course, with figures such as Inanna and Sumerian, and the practically synonymous Ishtar a little farther north, and Astarte a little farther west.
And with those figures, don't you usually see the goddess on the back of the feline sometimes?
She's sometimes on the back. Sometimes the felines make up part of her throne. Mm-hmm. Sometimes her foot is on the back of the lion.
Mm-hmm.
I think the earlier figures are showing connectedness, whereas the later figures, especially Ishtar, she becomes more associated with war, is shown more dominating the lion.
I
guess it's different kinds of feline figures depending on what part of Anatolia they're from. So apparently there were leopards at Çatalhöyük, which is in pretty much south-central Anatolia or Turkey.
So in other words, you're saying maybe you'll see lions where lions were in the area, and you'll see maybe leopards where leopards were native to the area. Is that
exactly?
Okay. And why felines, Miriam? Is it about a metaphor, as a connection to nature, or is there something specific about the feline?
It's a wonderful question. If we think about some other cultures of the Near East, for example, Egypt, think about Sekhmet and her
mm-hmm.
lion connections. And in a way, she's almost an aspect of Hathor in her, when Hathor is defending her father, Ra, and becomes violent and starts, you know, just raging through the city. This is Sekhmet. This is the concept of Sekhmet. The felines can be so powerful and so ferocious, and ferocity is an important aspect of the goddess, whether
mm-hmm.
it's completely nature, like, you know, earthquakes and violent storms and so forth, or later in the warrior eras, she becomes a warrior.
Well, you know, since you're bringing this to Sekhmet, and I'm really glad you did, because I've always wondered if when you see the lions of Kabylie, if you can sort of make that connection to Sekhmet, because she's a favorite of mine. You know, because I think it's, well, and you tell me, but if this isn't accurate, but just intuitively, I've always felt when I've looked at Sekhmet or I've looked at these lionesses, you know, it's even more than just ferocity. You know, when you see a mother lion with her cubs,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
it's about she's protective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's going to swipe you if you mess with her babies, but she's not this wanting killer either. You know, she's going to go out and kill for food, but, you know, it's, I don't know, I feel like she's almost an archetype for discernment and tenacity and protection and, I don't know, all of these things I see in the mother lioness.
That really works for me, and then it's pretty easy to see how there was an evolution of Bast, who becomes the protectress of the home.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
You know, and Bast sometimes is a little more like Sekhmet, and sometimes she's the cat.
Right. She can be the more domesticated,
mm-hmm.
tender, well, I would say the candle flame versus the, you know, the life-giving or sometimes devouring son of Sekhmet, you know, S-U-N,
uh-huh.
of Sekhmet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, good. I'm glad that there's a connection there between the Kabylie felines and the Egyptian cat goddesses. That's great.
This is intuitive on my part. I'm not.
Yeah.
I can't draw an exact connection, but certainly the cultures had been in communication for millennia.
Well, you know, just bear with me one more second. I know we're talking about Kabylie, but, you know, because I'm so interested in Sekhmet, I've always had this intuitive belief that that one myth we know about her, where she goes on the wanton rampage, could that have just been a reflection of patriarchy, you know, railing against the powerful female? Because, you know, I just don't see Sekhmet as this wanton killer, you know, the way the myth makes her out to be.
Well, she's not the only one who has that kind of myth. Anat, the Syrian Anat, has exactly the same kind of myth where she heads and hands are go flying and blood is everywhere and she delights in the gore.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a function of patriarchy. It's hard to tell because in the earliest historic texts, the cultures that produced them are already patriarchal, the texts that we're able to decipher.
Mm-hmm.
So the earliest Egyptian and the earliest Sumerian texts, these are products of their patriarchal cultures, and so you're going to find warfare and violence.
Well, and I'm very much into the big cats, and wherever I get a chance to go to these centers that are trying to preserve their genes and all of this, and they're trying to preserve the species. There was one in particular that I went to in Phoenix where you could actually, at the end of the day, when the lions were going to be fed, you could actually go along with the feeder, and it couldn't be squeamish. I have to admit, because they were thrown into the cages, like heads of cows and body parts and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, and I couldn't help but sort of, again, here I go, intuitively sort of pick up that, you really do have to sort of have a backbone to, maybe embrace, these archetypes, because they're the ones that are going to sort of steal you and, maybe teach the hard lessons that, maybe sort of define who we are. You can't be squeamish sometimes, because life isn't always, life isn't always pretty.
That's right. It's a wonderful point, because if we think about one of the most prevalent prehistoric icons, the snake, they require live food too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you can't, if you have snakes, I don't have one, but I knew someone who did, you can't be squeamish.
Yeah, you can't really romanticize it. You really
right.
just have to be pragmatic about it, about
mm-hmm.
life and death, and, because nature isn't all soft and fuzzy.
Well, just the fact that both birth and death exist. That,
and that's
if you're
a messy
squeamish,
business.
Forget it.
Yeah, both of those are a messy business. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to digress so much, but these are things that have been sort of mulling around in the back of my mind. So I'm glad I had the opportunity to talk to you about that, and just sort of get your feedback. But I'm sorry, I sort of got us off track here. We were
It's all fine.
Okay. Well, now Kabylie, I know she's an Anatolian region, and for listeners who don't, Anatolia doesn't automatically ring a bell. That's sort of where Turkey is today. The Chateau Hayuk, and all of that beautiful country, which I know you've traveled to several times.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what more you can about the essence of Kabylie, and how she becomes, where she gets all her attributes, and let me just get you back on track.
Okay, fine. Kabylie is found in western Anatolia. Her most famous site is in Phrygia, it's Midas City, and this is a very stark environment of mountains it's very stark nature, and there are temple facades carved into the mountains with Kabylie in the middle, always surrounded, always flanked by felines. And then sometimes you'll find some Phrygian at the very top of the carving. And these are huge, huge carvings. The temple facades are larger than life size. And this is where she was worshipped, was in nature, and she got her name from the Kubelian mountain. So there was no Cybele per se, or Kubele per se, in the Phrygian inscriptions, all of which I had to read to write my latest article. And there is absolutely no sign of just Kubele by itself. It's the Kubelian mountain. So she is the mountain mother. And this, she was borrowed by both the ancient Greeks and then the ancient Romans, and she was carried to Rome in the form of a slab of rock. And they just honored her as she was, as the Phrygian mother goddess, and they just called her the Great Mother.
So now when you say a slab of rock, we're not talking meteorite.
I think it's basalt.
Okay. And now, just a question about the lions again. Do you think there's any chance that they were domesticating those animals? Or?
Oh, I doubt it so much.
Yeah, that would be a stretch, I guess.
I think it's a stretch. I think that the animals are important to them for many reasons. But there is no evidence of the kind of domestication we think of, where they would be in the home. This is nature.
Mm-hmm.
This is out in nature.
So are we talking more about they would probably revere these animals like a shaman would, for the qualities they thought the animals imbued?
Exactly. And as we know now, the shamanistic, the great shamanistic era of the Upper Paleolithic very naturally merged into the Neolithic. There was no abrupt Neolithic revolution as people used to write. And so these shamanic practices lasted. In fact, the last time I was in Çatalhöyük, I particularly noticed this wonderful wall painting, which was replicated in their visitor center, but it was discovered in the excavations of Çatalhöyük, and it was of a hunt. And some of the figures, there are several kinds of human figures represented in the hunt, and there are some slightly larger figures with these very long fingers, and they're pointing to the animals, and I think they're invoking them. This is a kind of harmony, saying, please give your life up to us so we'll have some food to eat, but we honor you for it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. You're making me think of the movie Avatar.
Which I haven't seen yet, but I am going to so soon.
Oh, you have to. It's wonderful. I actually saw it twice.
That's good.
But that was one of the things, of course, they did. You know, I mean, they were connected to the animals. Literally everything that was native to the planet was literally interconnected. They actually plugged in, you know, to one another. And, of course, when they took the animal's life, they thanked it. For giving its life so that they could live. And it was beautiful. I mean, I really, when I watched the movie, I felt like I was in a sacred ritual, I have to tell you.
I have heard from other friends who have said exactly the same thing. I had an email recently from Pat Monahan, who wrote the book of Goddesses and Heroines, and she simply said, saw Avatar, wow.
Well, you know, I did a review of it for my Examiner column, and, you know, I opened with one of the most beautiful lines, I think, in the whole movie, was when the main character is kneeling at the Tree of Souls. And he's talking, because the indigenous Navi, they honored a mother goddess. And he says, oh, I got chill bumps and cried in the movie, I have to admit. He says, sky people, which was the earthlings, us, you know, we were coming, we were coming tomorrow, and they've already destroyed their mother, and now they're coming tomorrow for you. And it was like, oh, my God, how profound was that, you know? And, you know, there were a couple other, you know, really profound moments like that, that, I don't know, just because of the things we know and believe, you know, I think it was more meaningful for us to hear this, you know. Or when, you know, he's telling people, you know, he's telling the military, they're not going to move off their sacred land. What are we going to trade them? Budweiser and blue jeans? You know, it's like these people are living in paradise. They have everything. They don't want our junk. So anyway, I think you'll really enjoy it. But I'm sorry, we digress again. So now Kubaba, that was another female deity. I remember seeing her relief on some of the walls. I think it might have been the Anatolian Museum when we were in Turkey.
Oh, there are many of her, and she's holding what looks like a pomegranate and a mirror.
Yes, she was very important.
She was a minor deity among the Hittites, and then at the end of the Hittite Empire, she becomes very important south near Syria, and she and Carchemish especially, she has this great prestige, and she's a really important goddess. And it may be that she may have ended up being worshipped in Phrygia. It's hard to tell. The name Kubaba is very similar to the name Cybele, but there's so much scholarly debate whether or not the two are one that I decided not to join that debate and just look at their iconography.
Mm-hmm.
And there is certainly feline iconography. There is more feline iconography actually among the Hittites, not with Cybele, but with their great goddess. There are little texts that say, well, we sacrifice a sheep for Kubaba, but she is not the one who's mostly associated with felines. But she gathers iconography as she moves south and as she moves with time.
So now, help me with the dates. Is one older than the other, or do they exist parallel to each other?
The Hittite Empire existed from about 1800 BCE and until after 1250. 11-something, when a lot of the Bronze Age great civilizations were destroyed or close to destroyed. And so, for example, at the Hittite Yazilikaya, which is a rock-carved shrine, we see this procession of male deities, and then this and the principal one depicted is the weather god of the heavens, Teshub, and he's facing his wife Hebat, who wears a polos. Well, it's called in Greek a polos, which is very similar to Cybele's later polos, and she's standing on the back of a feline. So then, in the post Hittite period, there's a citadel, Buyukale, where there's a monument depicting Kubaba with musicians, and then Kubaba becomes very important in Carchemish in the 9th and 8th centuries BCE. So there is a progression through time with the Hittites earlier and then the Kubaba and the Phrygians a little later.
Well, now I know you have the ability to actually, you know, translate from some of these original sacred texts and things. You don't have to rely on other people's interpretations.
Right.
When you're researching these goddesses, are you finding much in the way of any of the ancient rituals or how they were worshipped or what the priestesses of these goddesses did, anything like that? Is it that specific? Can you find that information?
Yeah. Oh, sure. There, for example, there are lots and lots of Hittite prayers which give us a great deal of ritual, and they mention hundreds of deities. They were really protecting themselves. You know, they were calling on every deity they could think of, and they would not only their own deities, but deities of neighbors just to be safe.
Now, wasn't it the Romans that had, like, the unknown deity or something? They did the same thing or something because they were afraid they would forget somebody and invoke their wrath.
And they also were really great about assimilating the deities from other cultures. They assimilated Isis. They assimilated Kybele much more fully and much more readily than Isis, actually, and because it was predicted, there was an oracle that said that Hannibal would be conquered if the Romans were to build a temple for Kybele
in
their forum. And so they did, and they conquered Hannibal. And so she became hugely important to them. They didn't, although they also imported the Attis religion, a lot of people were against that for various reasons and, you know, didn't like the emasculation part of it and so forth.
Well, now, so in other words, from what you just said, am I interpreting correctly? Because, you know, I was about to ask you the question about how the Romans actually, at least I read that they had a distaste for the religion of Kybele and Attis, but it was more the Attis stuff. I mean,
the Attis part of it.
You could sort of separate the two, I guess, is what I'm
you
asking.
You could, and absolutely the greatest families in Rome very much honored Kybele. And some of them honored Attis. It's just that was rather late in the empire, and I think late in the empire it was sort of disintegrating anyway.
Well, now, when you look at Kybele, did she, I mean, I know you talked about the polos on her head, and that's, you know, for listeners who might not know what the polos is, that's sort of like city walls, isn't it?
Exactly, it's a crown. Exactly, it's a crown encompassing the walls of the city.
And so that sort of made her a protectress of the people.
Uh-huh.
So in a sense, I guess she was like Artemis of Ephesus, where she really sort of became this all-encompassing goddess that sort of ruled from womb to tomb, so to speak, as opposed to she wasn't just a goddess of agriculture or animals or something like that. She was,
exactly.
Was she bigger, you know, much more all-encompassing?
I think so. And of course, and it became really clear to me when we were at Ephesus this year that Kybele is Artemis of Ephesus. Artemis of Ephesus is flanked by felines, and she wears a polos.
Mm-hmm.
She is not very, you know, she is not Artemis the Huntress of classical Greece or you know, Diana of Rome.
So, well, you know, that's, if you could explain a little bit about that, because I know when I was, you know, many years ago when I was first learning about this, it was hard for me to understand how Diana was different than Artemis.
Well, they're very similar, but I think Diana...
more the maiden too, isn't she? Or?
Yes, but mainly the origins, the Roman deities seem to originate in many parts of Italy, and they're native to various towns, and then there's more and more assimilation, and the Greeks are so important to the Romans that they tend to assimilate then their deities to the Greek deities, and so pretty much Diana becomes Artemis, although certainly in the post-classical period, Diana is more associated with Hecate and the moon and witches and so forth.
Well, I know when we were in Turkey, sometimes you would see Diana of Ephesus, and I didn't know if that was a mistake or not, you know, when they were referring to Artemis, actually, you know?
Yes, I know. Except that Ephesus lasted for so long, it was important in the first century BCE, the first century CE. It was the site itself, I mean, you know, is so huge and so imposing, so grand, that it was just a very important ritual site.
Right. Well, and also, I'm remembering, you know, being there in that museum right adjacent the Ephesus archaeological site, and you go in, you actually see these beautiful statues of Artemis with the registers of all the animals all over her body.
Oh, just amazing.
It's incredible. It takes your breath away. I mean,
and yeah, it does. And the many breasts or many fruits or whatever they are on her chest. She's clearly a very different goddess, and she's a great goddess. She doesn't have just one function. You know, the Greeks and Romans tended to carve their deities up, and instead of these hugely important deities of multi-functions, they would have fewer and fewer functions. There'd be more and more deities. So Artemis was of the hunt, but you go, across the water to Turkey, and she's everything.
Right. Well, and that's a good point. You've actually verbalized something. I think I was sort of unconsciously or subconsciously realizing. In Turkey, it's such a hodgepodge of all of these cultures. It's so easy to see how one goddess sort of takes on the attributes of another, as time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
I really think of Turkey as probably one of the, one of the most interesting travel destinations, and it doesn't hurt that they're not on the Euro yet.
I know it makes life easier. It's so reasonable there. The food is so fantastic. The people are so friendly. It's one of my favorite places to go to.
Oh yeah, absolutely, me too. Well, I know we want to talk about your book, but I don't want to get off this subject before we cover, anything else that's important about Kabeli and the feline iconography. So, don't let me, stop you from, sharing what else you might want to, mention about the importance.
Well, I want to mention the earliest figure I found, and then a modern figure also associated with felines, just to show this continuity. The earliest one I found so far is from Göbekli Tepe, which is this amazing site in southeast Anatolia, just 6 miles north of Syria. And this female figure dating to 8,000 BCE, so that's 10,000 years ago, was in a shamanic dance position.
Mm-hmm.
And she was carved, but she's a display figure. She's very much Sheila Nagig-like.
Mm-hmm.
And she's carved in an area between pillars containing depictions of felines.
Mm-hmm.
And so here she is doing a shamanic dance associated with felines.
So that may be one of the oldest representations of her image then.
It's the oldest one I found so far. And then the most modern one I found, although it's lasted for over a millennium, is Devi, who as Durga, when she's fighting the various asuras, like the buffalo demon, she goes into battle riding on a lion.
Absolutely.
And there's art made about Devi, and Devi just means goddess in Sanskrit, female deity. She is always associated with the lion, and this art is being made even today.
Wow. If we could only have a time machine to go back and watch those shamanic dances and be like a fly on the wall. I can't think of anything more incredible than that would be.
Me too, and I'm more and more fascinated, therefore, with the Upper Paleolithic and these shamanic dancing female figures. That may be my next area of study.
Okay. Well, now, just a question about Chateau Hayuk. I know it's, sort of a controversial, place, and, because Ian Hodder, doesn't always agree with what, some of the feminist scholars say. Where do you sort of stand on that, Miriam, in terms of, the egalitarian, potential egalitarian society there, and, what Mellert and Gimbutas said versus what Ian Hodder says?
What's really interesting is Ian Hodder doesn't deny that the culture was egalitarian. Instead, he says Maria Gimbutas was wrong. It wasn't a matriarchy. Well, she never said it was a matriarchy. She said that it was an egalitarian society. The society was not very different from the previous hunting and gathering societies, which most scholars believe were, again, egalitarian.
Now, does he also have a problem with the idea that they were revered a goddess?
Yes, he has a huge problem with that, and that's where we differ.
Well, does he have good reason for that, or is this just, you know, here we go again, but, you know, through the male lens?
Well, I think it's the male lens, and he sees that all these female figures are found in domestic settings, but the domestic settings are honored as a part of ritual life. The grain bin is not only to produce today's bread, but it's grain with a capital G. I mean, you know, the perfect example of that in Greece is Demeter. Of course she's worshipped.
Well, I mean, it's almost silly. Okay, forgive me. I mean, you know, I don't have his credentials, but it's not like back then you had a grocery store. So, you know, it's like grain and the things of the hearth. I mean, you know, when you think of how hard life had to have been in those ancient times, mortality rates and things like that, anything that sustained life, that had to be hugely significant, not minor.
Exactly. It is the sustenance of life, and it has to be honored. So I think in early Neolithic society that spirit and ritual permeated all of life. That, you know, just as, you know, the shamanic dances were used before a big hunt. You didn't just go to the grocery stores, as you said. You had to go on a hunt, and you were going to ask the gods and the spirits of the animals for their help.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, it just goes back to, you know, that lack of being able to think in terms of everything being interconnected.
Exactly.
And if you think of everything being interconnected, it's almost, you know, I don't know, it just makes it a no-brainer.
I agree with you. It makes perfect sense to me. I have not been to Çatalhöyük when Ian Hodder has been there, and the woman who is the everyday in charge of the site, rather than just visiting on occasion, Shahina Farid, is really wonderful and very welcoming, and
well,
we visit her twice now.
Well, tell me if you can, I mean, if you feel comfortable, do you think maybe some of this is political? I mean, because, you know, the idea of the goddess and, you know, and all of that is sort of, you know, it's not the mainstream teachings, I guess, you know, it's still the goddess maybe is a rung or two below God. Do you think it's something to do with that? I mean, could it be just political because it's not the traditional, it's too risky to come out and say stuff like that?
I think so, and I think it goes even, although that is certainly true, I think it goes farther. Since Maria Gimbutas' death, there's been sort of an anti-Maria bandwagon that people have liked to climb on to try to prove her wrong, and even in instances misquoting her and then saying, see, this isn't true. And, you know, since the mid-70s, she never used the word matriarchy, and yet people would say, see, these cultures aren't matriarchal the way Maria said they were, so she has to be wrong.
Well, now, and it seems like to me, from a previous guest I had on the show, I had Isaac Bonowitz on recently, and he calls himself a heretic of matriarchies. And he didn't believe that there were matriarchies. And we had a guest call in what it seemed like was it's really in how you define matriarchy. Did I understand that right?
Yes. And before Peggy Reeves Sanday redefined matriarchy using a perfectly good Greek etymology as woman at the beginning rather than woman rule, you know, we've never had any proof of women actually ruling with an iron fist the way patriarchs do.
Right.
Matriarchy isn't the flip side of patriarchy. It is a culture where there is great equalitarianism, anti-violence, and women are honored, and the oldest, wisest woman may be it isn't so much head of the tribe as the person people go to for answers to things.
Well,
and her brother will make decisions with her rather than a husband consort.
Forgive this analogy because it might be off, but I have to tell you, as you're talking and you're describing, I'm thinking to myself, gee, that almost sounds like the difference between liberals and conservatives. You know, because here's the egalitarian matriarchies, you know, willing to share leadership, share ideas,
right.
Don't have to rule with an iron fist. You know, there's room for everybody, everybody's ideas kind of, versus the iron fist, you know, my way or the highway kind of a thing.
Exactly. No, it's a nice analogy.
Oh, well, it might just be my point of reference. I don't know. But, and I just wanted to make sure I understood that because it really seemed like some of these arguments we have among scholars, it's because we're not all using the same definitions even.
Mm.
So it can just be confusing for the layperson, you know, who doesn't know all
mm-hmm.
the intricacies. So was there anything else we wanted to cover about Cybele and Artemis and her associations there in that area before we go on to your book?
I think that we discussed the things that I was hoping to discuss.
Okay, cool. All right, well, now your book, let me find the title again. It's called Sacred Display, Divine and Magical Female Figures of Eurasia. So
yes.
Now, how are these different from the Sheila Nagids that show their genitals, or is it the same thing?
It's the same thing, except they're found all over the place, and the earliest figure, again, is at least 8,000 BCE, this figure that I was talking about from Göbekli Tepe, because she is doing this dance of display where her genitals are very much in evidence. There's something about the female genitals as perhaps as the entrance to the womb, which is the source of life, that was greatly honored in very ancient early prehistoric societies.
So now, it's hard for me to even language this question, but I guess I'm wondering if that's the case. I wonder if there were ever, you know, ancient rituals that actually honored, you know, the sacred display. You know, I mean, like I know when I was researching my book, they talked about, you know, this is a little bit crass, but you know, I didn't make it up. You know, in Japan, they actually, you know, do these dances that they say harken back to, you know, Uzumi. You know, like the Baobo. You know, where she lifts the skirt.
Well, exactly.
And they say in Japan, you know, some of these, you know, sort of floor shows, you know, the dancers actually are on stage and, you know, they're unclothed on the bottom part of their body and the people in the audience can actually see the genitals.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm wondering if there were, if there were any sacred rituals that might, you know, taking it out of that context that I'm talking about in Japan, but putting it in a sacred context, if the female genitals were actually ritualized or honored or,
well,
I don't know, save me, Miriam, I've got to put my foot in my mouth here.
I don't think you are, because, well, in the book I also talk about Amaterasu and this sacred dance of display, because it's echoed elsewhere. So I don't know if there was ritual embodying that, because I don't find text But there is certainly myth embodying that. There's not only the myth of Amaterasu, there's also the myth of Hathor, which I found relatively recently in researching this book. Hathor's father, who he's called in this text Pre-Herakti, and this is from the beginning of the first millennium BC, somewhere around 1060.
So is that another name for Ra?
Exactly. Pre-Herakti is another name for Ra, and he was very sad because he was taunted by a minor deity saying that he wasn't very important anymore and people weren't really going to honor him, and he became really sad. And the only way to bring him out of his sadness, and you may think of Demeter, was Hathor raised her skirts and boldly showed her genitals, I mean every bit of her genitals, fore and aft to him, and it explains it in detail in the text. And he laughed, and his sorrow was removed. And what happens to Demeter when Iambe in the Homeric hymn to Demeter does the same thing? She laughs, and then she calms down and is ready to negotiate. She certainly wants her daughter back, but she's going to negotiate and not just hit the earth with you know,
vengeance or something.
Yeah, and lack of vegetation.
Well, you know, I guess I am curious why the genitals inspire a laugh. I mean, is that meant to be,
it's
joy. So it's meant to be joy as opposed to something, what is it, the word ribald or ribald?
I don't think it's ribald. And I remember some ancient Ugaritic texts talking about someone laughing with his heart and his liver. There is something about that, that it's a release of sadness, and that's what we're talking about. If the sadness is released, there can be rebirth, regeneration.
Ah, okay. And how do you think, or why do you think, these such similar myths, how do they go from Japan to Egypt? Well, Egypt and Greece isn't such a stretch, but
right.
Japan, you know, and I think somebody else told me that there was another Norse, maybe it was a Norse story that...
Or
Iroquois or something like that.
Well, there's an old Norse story of Egil and Asmund, and they come upon a giantess. I think her name is Sea Eagle, something like that. And the giantess shows her genitals, and she's also very, very lustful. She's had sex with the god Odin, and ever since she can't control her lust. And this is a kind of sacred display.
Okay.
Well. So we find it all over the place. I don't know. Maybe it's maybe it's related to practices as early as the Upper Paleolithic.
But I mean, you know, these parts of the world are so diverse. I mean, especially like then you have the Iroquois. I think too, it's almost like a collective unconscious or something.
It may be, or it may be a reflection of a very early reality.
That's really interesting.
Well, we know that we all originated in the same, Homo sapiens sapiens originated in one place and spread out over the world.
Well, that's true. And when you think of it like that, you know, we're all sort of spawned from that same nest. So then maybe it isn't quite such a stretch.
Yeah, I think my intuition, and I could be totally wrong, is that it's not such a stretch and that there is it isn't coincidence. I've never truly believed in coincidences. It may take years, but usually one finds the connections.
Well, now, the Shilanigigs primarily are in Western Europe, correct?
Yes, they're mostly in Ireland with many in Britain.
But these sacred display, and I mean, is there a reason why you call them sacred display rather than Shila? Well, I guess because Shilanigig is more of a Celtic word or something, isn't
it? Yeah, Shilanigig, and we've never had a good definition even of what it means, although a few authors have at least tried to do etymologies. But Shilanigigs are Celtic, and you know, before the Germanic peoples came into Britain, this was the Celtic areas as well as parts of France and Germany. So broadly, Shilas are broadly Celtic. And this is sacred display that starts much earlier and is broadly geographic. And what was important for us was that Victor had found such similar figures in China and other parts of East Asia.
And are they all associated with fertility of people in the land? And
it's two important things. It's fertility, but it's also protection.
Okay.
If, for example, there is an Irish story. There's a few different Irish stories about women lifting their skirts and the enemy runs away. And there's the same. I mean, it's not the same story, but it has the same, I think, origins in China that of these women who all these women stand on the city wall and at the same time they lift up their skirts and the men run away.
That's hysterical.
I know.
So now, sacred display object sort of sounds like a contemporary term. Were they called different things in the different countries? I mean, like the Shil Nigigs were Celtic. Did they have their own terms in
they
China versus?
Well, although we don't find figures just like Shilas in China, we find practices that are very similar, and we also find total display figures that look like Shilas on late Neolithic Chinese pottery.
And I know with the Shilas, you know, people tended to go up and touch them. With these other sacred display objects, were they used like that as well? I mean, what, sympathetic magic, I guess?
It may be, although I don't see the evidence of wear on these other objects that I do on the Shilas. Definitely the genitals, you will find they're in areas they're rubbed away because people have been rubbing them and then kissing their fingers and hoping for fertility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, again, not just fertility, but protection. Like if they're on a church or castle wall, that church or castle is being protected.
Well,
invaders.
No, don't laugh. Don't laugh at me. But I tell you, the first Shila I saw was up over the top of a doorway. And
yeah.
The moment she's sitting there in her splendor with her knees spread. And, mm-hmm. you know, she's this haggard, skeletal old woman. And,
yes.
you know, I instantly felt that she was there because it meant if you walked across that threshold, it was like you were within her womb and you were within her protective sanctuary or something,
exactly.
You know?
Exactly. I think that if you go between her legs, you're in the womb.
Yeah, exactly.
And
sort
this
of,
is why she's often over doorways or lintels.
Well, and I guess this maybe ties into maybe in Malta where we have the mother-daughter temples where it looks,
mm-hmm.
it feels like you're walking through the vulva and the center of the circle is the womb.
Yeah, you feel, well, I truly do feel like the entrance to the Maltese temples is vaginal.
Okay.
I mean, it's this long corridor, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then you go into the center, the Holy of Holies.
Right.
And there are all these trilithons, which are like two legs and a torso.
Mm-hmm.
And
or
I
even,
think you're truly going into the body of the mother.
Well, and that's what I felt like in the Hypogeum as well. I know that I remember reading that the scholarship was kind of shoddy when they actually did the archaeology there. I'm not sure way back when it was first excavated, a professional actually did it, so they weren't really sure. But it just felt like that was, where they found the sleeping goddess. It just felt like
right.
that was the womb of the mother.
It felt like it to me when I was there.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And it was one of the most sacred places I've ever been in my life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I know you're a scholar, but how do you balance your left brain versus when you go to these places and you just intuitively, you know, get these hits? I mean, can you ignore that intuitive information?
I have been meditating for almost 35 years, and so my left brain and right brain are connected because this is what meditation does. You have more neural connections between the two parts of the brain. So I don't really try to even separate the two sides of my brain anymore. For example, when you're translating, yes, you need to have knowledge of the language and vocabulary and grammar, but when you're putting the words together, that's right brain, that's using intuition. So it's very hard to do translation without whole brain activity. And
okay.
For me, my joy is that, yes, I do scholarly work regarding these female figures, but they're also my passion and my life.
Well, you know, that reminds me of how I described at least Maria Gumbutas in my words. You know, I felt like she was probably one of the first people who these images spoke to her,
mm-hmm.
you know, and she had the nerve to not just write the science, but she had the nerve to write how they spoke to her as well. And,
I know.
And I think that's what where she gets in trouble with the hardcore scholars, I guess, huh?
Because she's interpreting the figurines.
Right.
And the figurines before Maria, pretty much, especially with work in Central and Eastern Europe, people were avoiding the figurines because, they, as Ernestine Elster says in Signs Out of Time, people just didn't know what to make of them. And then here Maria comes along and starts interpreting them, and at first people didn't even know how to assess her work. I mean, she had done all the, you know, the very basic work on the Bronze Age in Central Europe and Eastern Europe and so forth. And she was working, she was an Indo-Europeanist. She was working on Indo-Europeans, and all of a sudden she started noticing these cultures that were so different from the Indo-Europeans and earlier. And she started excavating thousands of female figurines on her major excavations, and it you know, she didn't go in looking for anything. It was there, and she
found her.
Yeah, it found her.
Well, and thank goodness for us, she was as courageous as she was.
I know.
But I think that must have been in her genes from her background.
Yes, yes. Her family was very courageous, smuggling books written in Lithuanian into Lithuania when you couldn't even have a street sign in Lithuania written in the Lithuanian language. They had to all be in Russian.
Wow. Well, and also, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just that they were very brave.
Well, and they were, they seemed so open-minded, too. I mean, they were so well-rounded. You know, her family,
yeah.
You know, they were all, you know, so well-educated, and, you know, they seemed just so ahead of their time, is I guess, a good way to describe at least my impression, you know, I had when I heard her family and, you know, where, you know, how she grew up, you know, with the sort of mindset that her family had. It just seemed like, I don't know.
Well, the fact that both her parents were doctors, that I think it was very motivating for her. She was also a concert-quality pianist. She was very well-rounded.
Well, and I guess, too, what I was trying to say is, you know, the girls were encouraged to do whatever it is they wanted to do. It wasn't
right.
This issue of, well, you know, they were going to have to just get married and have babies, you know.
Exactly.
And in that day and age, I mean, that was a little bit out of the norm, I would think.
I think it was. I think it was.
Well, but let's go back to your book. When is it going to actually be out?
Well, it's supposed to go to the printer by the third week of this month. So
oh, you must be excited.
I'm very excited. I think the end of this month or sometime in February.
Okay. Well, tell us more about it. What countries does it cover, and are there lots of gorgeous pictures? And
we do. We have over 40 illustrations and that we're very excited about, from all over, from Hathor to Indic Lhaja Gowrie figures. You know about the Lhaja Gowries?
No.
Oh, they're wonderful. And I was Several years ago, I was about to give a paper at a conference in South Africa, and the chair of our session was Miranda Shaw, who's done such fabulous work on Indic female figures. And so I was going to present on Shilina Giggs, and she said, well, have you read any work on Lodja Gowries? And I said, I haven't heard of them. And so she sent me a bibliography, and I read everything, and wow, these are female display figures, and they're found all over India in temples. And they're thought by everyone to bring good luck to the temples, and that if there's no Lodja Gowrie in a temple, it won't have good fortune.
Very interesting.
Yes, and these Lodja Gowrie figures they take acrobatic poses. The genitals are, well, the legs are straight up in the air. The genitals are completely displayed. The head is rarely human, although there are some Buddhist figures that have human heads. Mostly they're lotuses or snakes.
Hmm.
And there can be vegetation growing out of their navels. They often hold a lotus. They're very much associated with vegetation, with the chthonic, with snakes and so forth. I love that they're good fortune.
Well, they sound really interesting. And it makes me think, too, you know how a lot of the male phallus reliefs were defaced, you know, when Christians show up on the scene. I'm surprised that more of these sacred display images, hadn't been defaced either. Or were you just lucky enough to find some that escaped that?
Well, if you think about the Shilina Giggs, for example, they're not really defaced. They're rapidly decomposing because of the elements. But the Irish are fiercely protective of their Shilas. They love their Shilas. And they have this kind of Catholicism that's pretty well embracing of aspects we wouldn't consider to be Western or wouldn't consider to be Catholic. The fact that, you know, they converted deities such as Bridget. She became Bridget the nun.
Right,
and the abbess. And I think that they're very happy to live side by side with Catholicism and Shilina Giggs. And what we have found is in certainly Eastern cultures have managed to retain these figures because there isn't the fear over sexuality that we find often in the West, especially in Christianized countries.
Okay, makes sense. Well, yeah. If someone wanted to find your book, do you have a website or do they go to Amazon or?
I assume it'll be on Amazon. They can certainly find it at Cambria.com, the Cambria Press website. Because it isn't out yet, I haven't even tried to look to see where it might be.
Okay. All right. Well, did they let you see the cover?
Yes, we picked the. It's wonderful that Victor and I have been in complete accord every step of the process, which has made the writing of this book such a joy. I suggested to him the Kiltainen Shila because it perfectly illustrates what we're talking about. The Kiltainen has one leg raised, one leg down, one arm raised, one arm down. It's this shamanic dance she's doing, and at the same time she's pulling at her genitals. So it's the perfect shamanic dance / sacred display.
Mm-hmm.
And the image we're using was taken by Joe Kenny, who lives in County Fethard, and he very kindly allowed us to use his image, which we're using within the book and for the cover. And then Victor asked me what my favorite colors were, and I said, well, purple would be my first choice, and I guess blue my second. And he said, well, I really like purple. Let's do purple. So we have a purple background, this fabulous dancing Kiltainen and Shilina Gig on the cover. I absolutely love the cover.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. I can't wait to see it. Well, I bet. Are you going to be doing any kind of book launch or book tour in Southern California once it's out?
Probably at least a book launch. I haven't figured out what I'm going to do yet. I'm the sort of person who just sort of takes things as they come, and things always happen.
Okay, yeah, things will fall in place.
Yeah.
Well, so what would be one of the most important ideas you feel like maybe you want to leave listeners with, considering everything we talked about tonight, and we really sort of rambled in all sorts of directions?
I think the idea that I would like to leave people with the very most is related to the book, and that is the honoring of the numinous quality of the female genitals, the numinous quality, therefore, of the female, the numinous quality of the womb, not just wonderful and happy, but sacred, numinous.
Wonderful. Well, and it makes me think about how women are trying to reclaim their cycles and their sacred blood.
Exactly.
I mean, it's all tied together.
It is indeed.
It is all tied together. Well, that's a wonderful thought and tone to, close our conversation. Well, Miriam, thank you so much for, again, being a guest. You certainly are one of our foremothers and way showers. And, you know, thank you for, you know, all your wonderful research and, for the young and old minds that you inspire and nourish.
Thank you so much. And I'm just honored that you asked me to be on your program. It's so lovely. It's like a fireside chat that we have, except it's on the radio. And I thoroughly enjoyed it.
The only thing that would be better would be if we could show images. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yes, it would, wouldn't it?
If we could show listeners what we're actually talking about. Oh, you know, one last question before I let you go. I kept meaning to ask, and then I think about something else. That statue found at Chateau Hayuk, in the grain bin, you know,
mm-hmm,
that wouldn't be, because she's given birth, you see her actually, you know, something coming from between her legs. That wouldn't be a sacred display, would it?
I don't think it is. I looked at the original in the museum at Ankara.
Yeah.
I don't really see it's very
really
hard
baby.
To see what people think is a head coming out from between the legs. So I'm not positive she's giving birth. I'm not positive she isn't, but I'm not married to the idea.
So it might just be a flaw in the design or something, or
it may be how people have seen it. You know, they may be seeing something that I'm not positive is there. And I took a lot of photos and walked round and round and round it. And it's just really hard to tell.
Hard to tell. Well, yeah. But there are, artifacts in museums where you actually do see, you know, goddess given birth, you know, something actually coming from between her legs. But that's not really what you're talking about, sacred display. That's not a...
No, but in a way it is. For example, there are two images that we use in the book that Joan Marler was kind enough to allow us to use from the Maria Gimbutas archives. And one of them is of a female figure from Achillion giving birth, and another is an almost identical image from Malta. She's giving birth, but she has one arm raised, one arm down, and she's in this shamanic position. So it's adding the magic to the birth giving.
Mm.
So
well,
yeah, that is
combination.
Right. So that is sacred display. Display isn't about titillation. It's certainly not about having sex. These are not couples having sex. This is the woman saying, "Look at this. This is the most sacred thing you could possibly think of."
Right, absolutely. Oh, God, if we could only retrieve that concept, right, for women all around the world.
Mm-hmm. That's my great hope.
Well, you know, you're contributing to that uplifting of humanity's warped psyche. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, if you'd like to stay on the line, you're certainly welcome to hear the rest of the show. That's totally up to you. So I'm gonna mute your line now, though. And but you know, feel free to stick around if you want to, you know, hear the What's the Buzz segment.
And how much longer does this show go?
It'll probably be about maybe 20 more minutes.
I'm going to listen to at least part of it because I'll learn something.
All right. Well, great. Thank you so much again,
Thank you, Miriam.
For taking the time to talk to me and hear my crazy ideas and, you know, share everything you know with your listeners.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Good night.
Good night.
So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, and where I like to say whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save our world. And as our guest tonight was the delightful and brilliant Dr. Miriam Robbins Dexter, who is tasked with the important work of educating minds young and old. We thank her for her time tonight. Well, I am going to take just a very brief one-minute music break and return for our What's the Buzz segment. And for that minute, I am going to let you listen to Breath of Passion by the group Zingaya. And I will be right back, so please stay tuned. Don't leave me, because I'm coming back with good stuff. Listeners, it's time for our What's the Buzz segment, when I discuss the bees buzzing around in my bonnet related to what's happening out there in the world, whether it be about spirituality, goddess advocates, or issues related to women, girls, and ideals of the sacred feminine. To start off with, I wanted to make sure you know about the Shriver Report that's available on the internet to read online or download, or you can actually buy the book. It's an assessment of where women stand today, both good and bad. The Shriver Report says, a woman's nation changes everything. And I'm just going to give you a couple little brief snippets, and if you're interested, you can go to www.awomansnation.com. And it says, for the first time in our history, half of all U.S. workers are women. Mothers are the primary breadwinners or co-breadwinners in nearly two-thirds of American families. And that changes everything, not just for women, but also for men, for families, for bosses, for co-workers, for our society. This is a permanent change in our culture. The trend line of women workers rises in the future because the jobs women are most likely to hold are expected to increase compared to men's. This is a social transformation affecting nearly every aspect of our lives, how we work, how we play, and how we care for one another. For more than a year, Maria Shriver and the Center for American Progress explored this transformation of the way Americans live and work, a transformation difficult to imagine a generation ago when Shriver's uncle, President John F. Kennedy, created the first Commission on the Status of Women in 1961 and named Eleanor Roosevelt as its chair. Roosevelt would be pleased and proud to know that the footprint of today's American worker is as likely to be a heel as a boot, and she would likely enthusiastically embrace the effect that sea change has had on America. For example, men now agree with women that government and business need to provide flexible work schedules, better child care, family and medical leave, and equal pay. And over 80% of men and women agree businesses that fail to adapt to the needs of modern families risk losing good workers. So really good stuff in here, all different. They talk about whether the battle of the sexes is actually over. Go to www.awomansnation.com, and that's the Shriver Report. A woman's nation changes everything. The other thing I wanted to share with you is that you should be aware that Iran is holding Iranian feminist and human rights activists in prison, and the Feminist Majority Foundation has a petition you can sign if you go online. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Shirin Ebadi, her sister, a professor in dentistry, Nushin Ebadi, And then another person, Mansoori Shoje, I'm probably murdering these names, I apologize, a founder of the 1 Million Signatures Campaign for Women's Equality in Iran, and another person, Morteza Kazemian, a journalist, were arrested the evening of December 29th by the Ministry of Intelligence agents. If you go to feministmajority.com, there is actually a petition you can sign, and this petition says briefly, I am outraged by the imprisonment of these three people. They mention their names. I urge you immediately to free these women and other human rights activists. Shirin Ebadi has brought much honor to the Iranian people in her work for human rights, women's equality, and children. I stand in solidarity with the women and men demanding an end to discrimination, women's equality, and human rights under the Iranian law. So take a minute, show your solidarity with these women who have been so brave, and these petitions will actually go to the head of the judiciary in Iran, the president of Iran, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, and the Secretary General of the United Nations. Okay, then there's the story of the Saudi journalist who proposed that interesting idea to give women the right to four husbands, like men have the right to multiple wives. It's actually an article from The Guardian, which is a UK newspaper, and the title of the article is Polygamy for All. A Saudi journalist is demanding that women be given the right to four husbands, and maybe she has a point. Well, the writer of the article, Khaled Diab, says that he's describing the article written by a female Saudi journalist. And in the article, which is provocatively titled, My Four Husbands and I, Nadine Al-Badair quite sensibly posed the logical question. If Muslim men are entitled to marry up to four wives, why can't women, in the spirit of equality between believers, have four husbands? She says, I have long questions. Why does men who have a monopoly on this right, no one has been able to explain to me convincingly why it is I'm deprived of the right to polyandry, she complains. The outspoken Saudi then goes on to deconstruct and question the traditional justifications for polygamy, including that in the traditional patriarchal society, it's a shelter for widows, divorcees and women who can't find a spouse, that men have greater sexual appetites than women and easily get bored, that women can't handle more than one man, and that if women could have multiple husbands, determining paternity would not be possible. But that's an excuse made obsolete by modern science. So she goes on and says, tell me that I, as a woman, can't handle more than one man physically. I say that women who cheat on their husbands and the sellers of love, i.e. prostitutes, do much more, she counters. Unsurprisingly, the article's has triggered a furious response from the traditional male establishment. Some Islamic clerics have denounced the article and promised the blaspheming author divine retribution, while an Egyptian important person has decided not to wait that long and has already brought a lawsuit against her. While few have openly voiced support for her call for this kind of equality in Islamic marriage stakes, some Islamic authorities have defended her by saying that her true purpose was to highlight how badly some women are treated by their husbands, especially those who take a second or third wife, despite Islam's demand that a man treat all of his wives equally. The journalist ends her article with a call that society either allow polyandry for women or comes up with a new map of marriage. And one Cairo man believes that the way to go is to confine polygamy to the scrap heap of history. In our world today, polygamy should be unacceptable. There's no need for it. And besides, no man can truly love more than one woman and vice versa, he opined. And his view corresponds with that of the Egyptian mainstream. Although Islam permits polygamy, most Egyptians are jealously monogamous, with men who take on more than one wife often mocked or marginalized by the community, and the first wife often so full of shame that she requests a divorce. Nevertheless, the question remains, which is fairer and more equitable, monogamy or polygamy for all? anyway, I thought that was some interesting food for thought. And let's see, on a little bit more serious note, this is an article by Deborah McNutt, and you can find it if you want to read the whole thing, because I'm just going to give you a couple highlights. It's on the site called mostlywater.org, and Deborah McNutt is a feminist and an anti-war activist and a researcher living in Olympia, Washington, and her email there is there if you care to contact her. Anyway, she has written this article about privatizing women, military prostitution, and the Iraq occupation. And she explains, military prostitution has long been seen around U.S. bases in the Philippines, South Korea, Thailand, and other countries. But since the U.S. has begun to deploy forces to many Muslim countries, it can't be as open about enabling prostitution for its personnel. U.S. military deployments in the Gulf War, the Afghan War, and the Iraq War have reinvigorated prostitution and the trafficking of women in the Middle East. After the Gulf War, harsh economic sanctions forced many desperate Iraqi women into prostitution. The sex trade grew to such an extent that in 1999, Saddam ordered his paramilitary forces to crack down in Baghdad, resulting in the execution of these many women. Within the Green Zone in Iraq, a few brothels have been opened, you know, during the current war, and they're disguised as women's shelters, hairdressers, or even a Chinese restaurant, but they're usually closed by authorities after reports about their existence reach the media. One Army reservist, Patrick Lackett, said when he was on leave from Iraq in 2005, for $1, you can get a prostitute for 1 hour. It seems military officials turn a blind eye to the exploitation of women by military and contract personnel because they want to boost their men's morale. The most effective way for the military to prevent a public backlash, though, is to make sure that the embarrassing information is not revealed. The prostitution rings keep their tracks hidden, and it's not in the interest of the military or its private contractors to reveal any information that may damage the war effort. The fact that information is difficult to find, however, Deborah McNutt, the author of the article, says, is the reason to intensify her search and to make military prostitution a major issue of the women's and anti-war movements. It's our tax dollars, she says, that fuel the war in Iraq, and if any women are exploited as a result of the occupation, we owe it to them to take responsibility for these crimes. Her ultimate purpose in doing the research is not only to help expose these crimes against women, but to help build a movement to stop them. Missing from the discussion about Iraqi women's rights is how the U.S. occupation is creating new oppressions that destroy women's self-worth. It is our responsibility, she says, as Americans, to stop our military's abuse of women by ending the occupation. So that was Deborah McNutt on the site mostlywater.org. Just briefly, you should probably know this sad story. It comes from an Australian newspaper called the Australian.com.au. And a woman by the name of Kamisa Mohammed Sawadi, 75 years old, is scheduled to be flogged simply for associating with men. Human rights watchdog Amnesty International has called on Saudi Arabia to stay a sentence of 40 lashes handed down against the 75-year-old woman for breaching the kingdom's sex segregation rules. Amnesty said all avenues of appeal have been exhausted in Saudi courts against this woman and the couple younger men she was with, and the conviction for being in the company of members of the opposite sex who were not close relatives is her crime. The Middle East and North African, it is abhorrent that an elderly woman is at risk of 40 lashes, says the deputy director of the watchdog's Middle East and North African program, Philip Luther. Very sad story indeed. And our last little story for tonight I want to share comes from a website, a blog called The Mark News, MARKnews.com. And it says, "Where's the outcry? In the case of the systemic oppression of women in other countries and cultures, we, the public, have only ourselves to blame." And the author of this is Lauren Oates. She's a professional human rights advocate and women's rights advocate in Afghanistan. And just briefly, she says, "The pace of real change has been lethargic, and the reality remains that violence against women and the international movement for women's human rights are found nowhere near front and center of our everyday concerns, our everyday conversations, or in what we demand from our leaders. From 1996 to 2001, when the Taliban imposed their bizarre and cruel collection of edicts designed to stifle the life out of Afghan women and girls, the Western world barely noticed. The destruction of age-old Buddha statues merited louder outcry than when women, dragged by their hair and buried to their waists, were stoned to death in Kabul's sports stadium, accused of adultery or prostitution. Canadians were mildly intrigued by photos of burqa-clad women who looked like blue ghosts haunting the destroyed streets of Kabul during those years, but there was no protest of thousands in the streets demanding that girls' schools be reopened and that women be allowed to work, to leave their homes without a male guardian, or to speak aloud again. The small feminist community of the Western world, joined by an equally small number of ordinary people who were outraged at both the Taliban's cruelty and at the world's silence, were witnessing a horror so extreme they dubbed it gendercide or gender apartheid. But a much larger number of people said, well, that's their culture and we mustn't interfere. Cultural relativism had gone mainstream. As Nick Cohen recently wrote, "For all the qualifications, the stubborn fact remains that mainstream opinion does not consider the oppression of women a pressing concern when it's done in the name of culture or religion. The misogyny they generate does not move hearts or stir passions. In matters of social justice, climate change, health care reform, child protection, well, we usually rightfully start by accusing our governments of a lack of will, of inaction, of breaking promises. We can also blame the media on stories and causes it values or doesn't value. But in this case, in the case of the systemic oppression of women in other countries and cultures, we, the public, have only ourselves to blame. We have allowed men to act out their perversions by keeping women in sexual submission under the guise of faith and helped excuse the leaders of Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and other countries out of the inconvenience of reforming laws and practices that facilitate the torture, rape, captivity, mental illness, and death of women and girls. The backwardness and inhumanity of oppressing women has not been acknowledged for what it is because we, in our privileged and free society, have yet to call it for what it is. In fact, we have not only failed to speak out loud enough or en masse, some have even defended the gender inequalities that still characterize the world in the 21st century." Well, while this, human rights and women's oppression is extremely important, I personally have to say there's so many atrocities we allow right here in the United States. Just look at how corporations control our government. That's just one example. And we sit back and do nothing. And I can't help but remember being in Paris with my husband 1 year when the subway workers' demands weren't being met. Well, you know what? They stopped the city. When you stop the subways, that, you know, you had a real sense that everything else in the city just stopped. And, you know, we Americans are so complacent about way too much, and we better start doing more than talking about it. We better get organized and demand our government start serving the needs of the people and not groups that put profits first. That's just my two cents. Well, I'll save the rest for our next session of What's the Buzz. I have some wonderful comments by Nicholas Kristof, famous author of the book Half the Sky, who is an outspoken advocate of women's rights. And, you know, if you're wondering why I consistently have this segment, with each show, well, it's important to shed the light of day on injustice and oppression. We just can't count on people to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. We have to keep the pressure on because the divisiveness and the programming in some places is just so pervasive. I mean, there are people here in the United States that think women shouldn't go to work, that, you know, women just are here to serve men. Just the oppression and the isms are just a lot to overcome. So we have to keep the pressure on because, like I said, the programming has been so pervasive. Fearmongers and intolerant can be deafening, and they often seem to sometimes be even ratcheting up their dogma and talking even louder. And we have to constantly educate, whether it's about women's issues or religion or just plain human issues. There's so much disinformation, so much intentional deflection going on. We have to really inoculate ourselves against ignorance, intolerance, and, like I said, those insidious isms. So I encourage you to do the same. Share this information with your loved ones. Sign online petitions in solidarity of causes that perpetuate ideals of the divine feminine and those that free and uplift women. Volunteer. Start a book circle. Do whatever you feel called to do. So with that being said, the bees are released from my bonnet for yet another week. Well, we are in our Four Mothers and Way Showers series full force, and at the top of the hour I mentioned we're about midway through. Next week our guest is Lisa Teach. She'll be discussing the dimensions of spiritual experience found in imagination, dreams, vision, and fantasy. We'll examine some indigenous beliefs and practices around these and compare them to ideas that Western psychology holds. We'll also discuss some dream symbolism and the role that mythology and art play in this regard. Mid-month, we have Carol Crist on January 20th, and if she's sticking to her topic, we'll discuss a little bit more about Maria Gimbutas' theories and language of the goddess and the controversies around power and prehistory. She just might get into discussion of the sacred places of Crete, Eleusis, and Lesbos, and the great teacher and poet Sappho, if there's time. And we finish out January with the noted scholar and activist, Jean Shinoda Bolen. And let's see, you asked, where are the Four Mothers and the Way Showers? Well, they are here every week, and usually on Wednesday nights at 6 p.m. Pacific, and generously still giving more of their time for you to hear what's stoking their passions these days. Like tonight with Marian Robbins Dexter and her new book about sacred display objects that'll be coming out really soon. You asked, where they were, and they are right here, so keep tuning in. Now, if you're new to Voices of the Sacred Feminine on Blog Talk, remember, we can take your caller questions. So in shows to come, if you like, dial in and ask questions toward the end of the interview. You can also email questions before the show. I'm happy to ask the guest your questions if you'd rather not be on the air. But if you do call in, and I see your call on the switchboard, I'll identify you by your area code and welcome you to have a chance to chat with our guests. So don't be shy. Call in. And if you can't listen live or don't want to be on the air, as I said, just email me ahead of time, and your questions will be asked of the guests. But keep tuning in each Wednesday at 6. Don't miss us. In fact, you can join Blog Talk as a listener and have reminders sent to your email box of our shows so you won't forget about our awesome guests each week. And please, if you're a fan of the show, if you like what you've been hearing, please indicate that by selecting us as a favorite on Blog Talk Radio. Well, just a few brief announcements before I close the show for tonight. I hope you'll check out my articles on examiner.com. It's kind of like my blog. I'm one of the very few goddess advocates in the U.S. writing for the Examiner. You can find them by going to examiner.com and put my name in the search box. Articles by me or about me will pop up, and you can just go to my website, KarenTate.com, And on the homepage, you'll find a link that'll take you directly to my articles. My mentors have inspired me to do my small part out there in the world, try to be visible teaching and activating minds and hearts about ideals of the sacred feminine that address cultural issues, women's issues, and the politics of spirituality, whether it be healthcare, sexism, or the inhumanity of political platforms that put profits before people. This Saturday is the first of 11 classes I'm teaching at the Goddess Temple of Orange County. The curriculum is in feminist theology called Cakes for the Queen of Heaven. You might think of it as Goddess 101. This week, the topic of the class will be the sacred female. And then on January 23rd, in the name of the mother and daughter, we'll be talking about the Demeter-Persephone myth. February 13th, Woman Power. February 27th, The First Turning, The Shift from Goddess to God. March 13th, Reclaiming Women's Heritage of Power. And then the second series starts, and we'll be talking about the Hebrew goddess, Sarah the priestess, the Apostle Mary, the Virgin Mary, witchcraft, and intentions. So, as so many people have said, this curriculum put out by the Unitarian Universalists has changed lives. And when you understand the historical roots of this, the phenomena of feminist spirituality, of goddess spirituality, not only do you empower yourself and improve your personal life, but you can help improve the lives of women and families everywhere. For more information about that, just contact me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. I'll also be giving a talk on sacred places of goddess around the world in January at the Sophia Temple, otherwise called Olindor. That's the home of Carla and Leigh McCloskey. So if you're interested, if you're going to be around Malibu and toward the end of January, let me know. I'll fill you in on that. Let's see. Please go to the media page of my website. Catch the new radio interviews I'm doing. I just did one with a South African radio station, and I talked about sacred feminine for a sustainable future. And you can also get free downloadable meditations on my website at KarenTate.com. And when you're there, please get to know me a little better. If you haven't already, check out my two books. Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, I'm proud to say has garnered some prestigious endorsements. And Walking an Ancient Path, it won a place as a finalist in the USA National Best Books of 2008. The scholar David Hillman has remarked that the book is an immensely pleasurable, enlightening journey, but the part that I like the best, he says, it stands boldly against the patriarchal denigration of the divine feminine. Check out my events page, see if I'll be appearing in a town near you, see what talks I have available to give your group. I'm happy to travel outside LA if I have a sponsor. You can check out my articles and links page, referring you to people around the world really trying to make a difference. And notice the special I have for listeners in my Goddess store. You can get both of my books for $25 plus shipping and handling, which is actually cheaper than getting them new on Amazon. So tonight's evening prayer, I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath with me and bring an even deeper focus to these lovely words of this short prayer. Grandmother Spider, we honor you within us, as every day with your help we weave our sacred web of life. All honor and gratitude to you, Grandmother. Well, as I say goodbye for another week, I'd like to leave you with another of my favorite musical pieces by one of the generous artists who have allowed me to play their music here on the show. And I don't know, after all of that talk about the feline goddesses with Miriam tonight, I think I'm going to honor Sekhmet and play by Caitlin Breen and Zingaya again. This song that they created to honor Sekhmet, who has her temple out in right outside Las Vegas, where this group hails from. So, as I leave you with this piece called Sekhmet by Zingaya, good night and thank you for tuning in. And I hope you'll be back with us next Wednesday at 6 p.m. Pacific.
desert, heart, fire.